Hello, my name is Supasani Sirapun, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Today, I'm joined by Jacqueline Pfeffer-Merrill, the director of the Campus Free Expression Project at the Council of Independent Colleges. She's visiting Dickinson to give a lecture on open inquiry and the collegiate mission. I've had the honor of working on this program, and I'm excited that she's joining me today to discuss her work. Welcome, Dr. Pfeffer-Merrill.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here.
So to begin, can you tell me a little bit about the Campus Free Expression Project and what it aims to achieve in higher education institutions?
The Campus Free Expression Project aims to support colleges and universities in creating safe and welcoming environments for a robust intellectual exchange so that we can support colleges in their work of preparing the next generation of citizens and civic leaders.
And I also understand you have a long history of teaching in higher education, like St. John's College. What prompted you to create the Campus Free Expression Project?
So I was a faculty member for 11 years, first at the College of William and Mary, and then at St. John's College in Annapolis. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to join the Bipartisan Policy Center and create a Campus Free Expression Project there, which seemed to me a way of continuing my work in the liberal arts, because open inquiry and free expression is both part of the civic mission of higher education, but also really essential to the academic mission of colleges and universities.
Right. And I'm particularly interested in your experience teaching in the college program at Maryland's only prison for women. What was it like, and how does it impact the work that you do now?
So I have been involved in the Goucher Prison Education Partnership since 2010, before we had the affiliation with Goucher, and I only have taught inside the women's prison once, and I got to teach astronomy for non-scientists, which was a terrific experience. But I have been involved in that program for now 16 years because I think the liberal arts are an inheritance for all of us, and the students who are incarcerated are people who can benefit from the liberal arts just as the rest of us, and using core texts, serious academic studies, focusing on books to reflect on their own experience and to change the community within the walls of the prison. One thing that's really exciting about teaching incarcerated students is for them, it's such a unusual opportunity for incarcerated people. And when one teaches incarcerated students, you know, the students are always so eager to have the readings done and take advantage of the time that you have together in the classroom, because it's not like an ordinary campus setting where you have office hours and you can just email the students because they don't have access to email. So I think it really connects me with my core understanding of what the liberal arts are, that they are for, you know, for liberty, for being a free person. And that's especially powerfully reinforced in an incarcerated setting.
Wow, that's a really, really strong message. When you talk about the liberal arts, Dickinson is a college that prides itself on being interdisciplinary and being a liberal arts college, but it also has policies such as bias reporting, which some argue is an infringement on free speech. So how do private institutions like Dickinson navigate free speech but still ensure a free and safe space for students?
That's an excellent and important question. So there's, you know, questions about particular policies and practices and you know, questions about thinking about the culture for open inquiry in general. Because while you've asked about a specific policy of having a biased reporting system, you know, a person can have the best policies to have safeguards and backstops for free expression and academic freedom, and can have all kinds of programs like the Discourses Across Differences program that are meant to foster civil discourse. But without that real culture of open inquiry and, you know, give and take and opportunity for students really to engage with others and feel confident that they're getting a hearing and they have a chance to ask questions of their peers and stress test their own ideas, it doesn't make for a true culture of exchange. So the, you know, the culture is always more important than a specific policies, I think. With regard to bias reporting systems, the Academic Leaders Task Force discussed these policies. The Academic Leaders Task Force is a group of 12 academic leaders co-chaired by two former governors who, of course, oversaw public university systems in their states. And Governor Chris Gregoire of Washington State and Governor Jim Douglas of Vermont. And while the task force thinks it's really important for people to be able to, who feel that they've experienced something that has compromised their ability to be somebody who is genuinely included in the learning community of the college, it's a way a bias reporting system can sometimes incentivize people to file a complaint rather than think about having a conversation with a faculty member whose, you know, class, in whose class the particular situation occurred, or to pursue some other way of resolving the discomfort and even offense in conversation, which is what we have to do when we get out into the wider worlds beyond college.
Right. And when you mention complaint, it kind of takes me to the idea of deplatforming, so the act of removing a space for somebody to talk. I know Dickinson had a similar incident last year with the commencement speaker, which is an honor, but also just for regular speakers in general. If a speaker is controversial, what role does a college administration play in supporting or removing that speaker, granted the student body is against that?
Thanks for that question. And I'm not going to comment on the specifics of what took place at Dickinson in the last year. And I think it's important to think about commencement speakers in one category who are part of a celebratory occasion, and speakers who are invited to give a guest lecture, as I was, or are invited by a faculty member to come give a class. When one is thinking about speakers invited to the college, you know, the question is always, how is it that they are advancing the academic mission? And that academic mission is to introduce students to a wide range of perspectives and viewpoints, and especially for a small residential school like Dickinson, where there are, you know, 2,000 some students, there are only a certain number of faculty members. Even however terrific they are, they don't have expertise in all the controversies and topics and questions that it's important for students to have a chance to be introduced to. So faculty should be, you know, thoughtful about who it is that is being invited with a view to the academic mission of the whole college or their particular course. And student clubs should be, you know, thoughtful about how it is that the speaker whom they invite in conversation with their faculty advisor serves the mission of the club. So one has certainly seen instances of provocateurs being invited to campus. Milo even got invited again to Penn State relatively recently. But with those things in mind, I think what the opportunity a guest speaker brings is to hear something that one wouldn't hear otherwise. And in a democracy, that is going to be something that happens to you every single day of the week. So to disinvite a speaker who has been invited, I think is not a good practice, because it deprives the students or the faculty member who invited that and anybody in the community who wanted to attend the opportunity to hear from that speaker.
For sure. I love how you mentioned the real world and how once we graduate, since I'm a student myself, once we graduate from these institutions, we're going to be thrust into a world where we're definitely not going to see eye to eye with almost anybody that we meet. So my question is, I feel the younger generation has been seen as a very sensitive generation that has been kind of synonymous with cancel culture. So what are your opinions on that? Do you think it's just a generation thing, or do you think a lot of people in general are more afraid of speaking up in general and in fear of being canceled?
I don't think it's necessarily a generational question, and it's certainly not just a college question or a Gen Z question. I think it's the case that free expression and open inquiry are values that are under stress in our democracy altogether. With regard to the students who are on college campuses today, you know, thinking particularly of residential colleges where students are typically 18 to 22, the average age of an undergraduate in the United States is now about 25. So we're talking about a specific subset of undergraduate students. This generation grew up at a time where neighborhoods were more homogeneous than was typical. For example, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, people grew up in think-alike neighborhoods where they typically meet few people who are of different socioeconomic statuses, whose political viewpoints, whose news sources, whose race, whose religion differs very dramatically from their own. There's been what one scholar has called a big sort, and people grew up in neighborhoods where there's not a lot of variety. That was, of course, compounded for this generation of 18 to 22-year-olds who were in high school during the time of the COVID-19 pandemic or just heading off to university. And that led to a time when people in this crucial high school period had fewer opportunities to mingle even amongst their high school. I mean, they were in pods of 10 people. So I think students arrive today with a underdeveloped skill set through no fault of their own when they arrive on campus and meet people with very diverse backgrounds. I know here at Dickinson, people come from almost every state, from many countries around the world, people who are here on F1 visas, or student visas of different sorts. And so it's no wonder that it's difficult to navigate meeting with and hearing from things that really challenge your priors.
Yeah, you mentioned skill set, which is something I kind of want to hone in on a bit, because Dickinson has the Dialogues Across Differences project, which is something that students, like a course that students can take to just learn about how to facilitate discourse and how to have respectful conversations with one another. Do you think that higher education institutions should be developing more of a model of that? Not exactly maybe a class, but just more of a like robust skill set for students so that they're able to have conversations with people that don't see eye to eye with them?
Well, I think the biggest frame for that question is, what is the purpose of attending an undergraduate institution? You know, what is it that we are hoping as a society people learn as an undergraduate? And we hope that they learn certain academic skills. We hope that they get prepared to enter the workforce. But the biggest public investment in higher education is that people become prepared to be engaged citizens and civic leaders. So that's the frame from which we have to begin. And in our pluralistic democracy, how it is that we make decisions is not through the loudest voice, it's not through force, it's not even by simple majority vote, but it is ultimately through discourse about ideas and policies and what's best for our community. So students have to graduate with that skill because that's what a pluralistic democracy requires. So with that in view, I think that it's really important for colleges to thread that through the entire experience from a first-year orientation where students get introduced to the ideas of free expression and open inquiry and civil discourse throughout their first-year courses. And I know that here at Dickinson, you have a first-year seminar where that skill can be developed under the guidance and guardrails that are provided by a faculty member through the co-curriculars, extracurriculars, and at every stage of undergraduate courses.
Right. And I kind of want to circle back to the real-world example that you mentioned about the value of an education and how it's supposed to prepare us to have that pluralistic democracy that we're living in. So I'm sure both of us have friends, families, coworkers who have different views than us, but when we live in a society, do you have any advice on how to navigate those relationships without breaking any barriers or breaking trust?
I think trust is the key word here. I mean, trust is really important in a democracy, and it's important both on the widest level and it's in our particular neighborhoods and institutions. I think I want to look back to the experiences that I had working for 5.5 years at the Bipartisan Policy Center, which for me was a wonderful experience in that amongst my colleagues, I had people who were getting, who had served in the first Trump administration, were getting ready to vote for Donald Trump for the third time when I left last summer, and colleagues who were far to the left of the Biden administration and had worked for the Biden administration or had worked for in various Democrats on the Hill or in state houses across the country. So on a day-to-day basis, people with extremely different political outlooks were working together on housing policy, on electoral reform and building confidence in the electoral system, on rural health initiatives. So I know it can be done, and it's just exciting and invigorating to do that. I think when we're meeting people for the first time, I think one of the things that's important are to, jump in the shallow end of the pool. Don't start asking about the most difficult topics right at the first. And we often talk about being a good listener and showing empathy, but I think we should talk more about the civic virtue of courage, to notice when other people are having a hard time getting in the conversation and making way for them, when they say something with which others are disagreeing, and maybe even with which we sharply disagree, to make sure that we make space and clear space for that person in the conversation and say, hey, wait a minute, I think this person is trying to make their case, and I want to hear more about it.
All right, and just to wrap everything up, do you have any advice for college students, students who are feeling a bit afraid of learning how to have that dialogue and discourse and are a bit afraid to speak up? Where should they start?
I do really think we underestimate the role of courage and civic courage in these conversations. I think it's good for people to have a set of stock phrases. I mean, people who are preparing to graduate are told, what's your 30-second elevator pitch about why an employer should hire you? But I think it does well for all of us to have like 5 one-sentence questions in our mind that we can pull out when we hear things that are really challenging to us. For example, when did you first think that way? Or, I don't see it that way, tell me more. Or, what's the thing that most makes you think that way? I think having those questions at the ready so that when we have something presented to us which seems really wrong or really disagreeable, we're ready to respond with a question that's on the tip of our tongue. I think that is really an important skill set.
Thank you so much. And on behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you again for coming and sharing your time and perspective with us at Dickinson College.
I'm so grateful for the invitation and delighted to have been here. Thank you.